Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And it's my turn to throw out the number of the week for you, Rebecca.
Putting on my thinking cap.
So today's number of the week is $1.50.
$1.50.
Yes.
That could be a lot of things. I need a hint.
Okay. Okay, here's your hint. It's part of a very big New York Times story that's actually starting to influence policy.
Oh, wait, I think I know what it is. Is it the very common and very low hourly wage for exploited nail salon workers in New York City?
Ding, ding, ding.
You got it. What do I win? What did I win?
You win nothing because that's depressing.
Do I at least win the opportunity to do an interview about that series?
Yes, you do. That's why I figured this would be a softball number of the week, because tell us about the interview that you have coming
up. Well, conveniently, I have an interview coming up that apparently I should have picked a better prize for myself rather than something I already had. So I'm really pleased that we're going to be interviewing Maya Pinto from the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum about that fabulous and really horrifying New York Times investigative reporting, a series called Unvarnished, which really digs deep into the dark side of the nail salon industry. And we're going to really use that conversation as a jumping off point to talking about exploitation of low-wage workers and particularly immigrant low-wage workers.
And you have another interesting interview lined up for us also with the president of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, Patrick McCarthy. Tell us about what that's going
to
be.
Yeah, so I'm excited to have Patrick McCarthy here to talk about a new report that has just come out hot off the presses from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, taking a look at our child welfare system. And we'll also be talking more broadly about child poverty and challenges that children aging out of the foster care system can face.
And if you all haven't noticed by now, I'm cutting out of this episode early. I'm not doing any of those interviews. I'm actually heading out to Oakland, California.
You're leaving in the middle of the episode, Tracy? This is bold.
I'm leaving, but, you know, I'm going on a bit of a vacation to visit my family, but also I'm going to have the opportunity to speak to some people out there about the changing face of Oakland and how gentrification is impacting people. So stay tuned for that.
I'm glad you're at least making it worth our while. I'm a little jealous that not only are you taking a vacation, but you're going to be out on the West Coast. Does that make you our weekly worst, maybe?
You know what? If that's the label I get for it, I'm willing to take it.
Well, that's convenient, because if that's our weekly worst, that saves us bringing in Alan Pike from Think Progress. Alan, you're off the hook.
But before I leave, we do have a wonderful interview lined up with Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And I think that's going to be a fantastic interview.
Let's bring her in. We are extremely pleased to have with us an extra special guest, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Katrina, we are so pleased to have you here. Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
And we're particularly excited to have you joining Talk Poverty Radio because the editor-in-chief of TalkPoverty.org, as well as one of the co-executive producers of Talk Poverty Radio, is Greg Kaufman, who previously was the poverty correspondent at The Nation.
You know, my view is you never leave The Nation. I still think of Greg as the poverty correspondent at large for The Nation.
Absolutely. And we try to lift up the voices of low-income people on Talk Poverty Radio and TalkPoverty.org. And you were instrumental in the launch of our blog, and we are grateful for it. I know we can speak for Greg when we say that we appreciate all that The Nation has done for our launch.
Terrific.
It sounds like you also gave him a promotion, too. Now he's the poverty correspondent at large.
Well, for many years, I was editor at large, or as I used to think about it, editor at large and at Liberty. And I think the ability to craft something important at CAP in the heart of Washington, where, let's be honest, there isn't enough attention paid to the voices of the poor, to poor people, I think it's especially important that it's based there and that it move out, of course, across the country, even internationally at times, to draw up the voices and the lessons. One of the things, you know, I'm proud of at The Nation is that we have just not bought into the Beltway consensus. Not in this past year, not over the last 150 years. And I think what you're doing is really very important.
And that means a lot coming from you, especially because we know that The Nation is the oldest political weekly magazine in the country and was founded by abolitionists, so has a great position and legacy in reporting on critical issues. So we're curious, do the roots of your magazine inform your approach to covering poverty in America? And also, what is your take on the way that the broader, you know, mainstream media covers poverty?
You know, it is the case we're celebrating, marking our 150th. The Nation, as you said, is the oldest political weekly. What I value so much is that The Nation has always understood the special responsibility it has to report what's otherwise going unreported and to air what might be unpopular views and controversial issues and to lift up ideas at a certain time which may seem heretical, but a generation later are more accepted. But poverty coverage has been in our DNA since the very beginning, as has the belief that one needs a moral compass. It's often hard to maintain, to navigate by it, but I hope in some ways that The Nation has been a kind of North Star of the left. The Nation's founding prospectus, as I write in my introduction to the 150th special issue, which came out in March, you know, the very first issue called for, quote, a more equal distribution of the fruits of progress and civilization. And that still seems like a good idea. Over, you know, the decades, we've had people like Martin Luther King Jr., who was our civil rights correspondent from 1961 to 1966. And in his last piece in The Nation, for The Nation, called The Last Steep Ascent in March 1966, he writes about poverty. He writes, it's easy to conceive of a plan to raise the minimum wage and thus in a single stroke extract millions of people from poverty. But between the conception and the realization, there lies a formidable wall. I think that is the case today. Just a few months later, Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward wrote about a poor people's movement, ensuring that poor people's voices would be heard by those representatives elected to office, W.E.B. Du Bois, James Baldwin, Barbara Ehrenreich, whose great piece and then book, Nickel and Dimed, I think played such a significant role in understanding how full-time work may still leave people living in poverty. So there are many others who've written about poverty in America and in the world for The Nation. And I just say, you know, with modesty, The Nation has been about truth-telling, speaking truth to power, and even more than that, a belief that you can make change when you tell people the truth. And we've had a faith in that. So I think all of those have led us to commit to media coverage of poverty that, again, as I said earlier, Greg has been so terrific in doing, ensuring that poor people's voices are heard, because too often, you know this, poverty can seem abstract. Poverty can seem so distant, but it's really very close and important and is, you know, part, again, of The Nation's DNA and something we are committed to continuing to cover in many different ways.
The past several weeks have seen just a tremendous amount of coverage within the media and sort of national discourse about poverty, particularly because of the events in Baltimore, but also because of a recent event that President Obama participated in at Georgetown University, which was really dubbed a poverty summit. And he spoke at that event at length as part of a panel discussion with Arthur Brooks, the president of AEI, Robert Putnam, the author of a recent book, Our Kids, looking at child poverty in the U.S. And the panel was moderated by E.J. Dion of the Washington Post. And Obama, as part of that panel, really spoke at length about poverty in the United States. What were your thoughts on his remarks?
Well, I come back again to what is so important about your project at CAP, which is that you listen to the voices of the poor, because I think it has to be said, and with respect for E.J. Dion, by the way, who's a colleague of mine, I write a weekly column for thewashingtonpost.com, and I like E.J.'s work, but there was something in the organization of this panel which rankled. I mean, what is it with D.C., poverty, and white men? You know, weren't there any women, maybe even women of color, maybe someone who has lived or is living in poverty, someone who lives in a high-poverty neighborhood, to kind of leaven the discussion? But that said, it is always important when there is high-level focus on poverty and a discussion. And I think President Obama is, you know, I'm reminded of the great African-American singer Odetta. To paraphrase her, she used to say, why can't we all just get along? And I think that is so much about Obama. That was the famous speech which lifted him up in 2004 at the Democratic Convention, And he just doesn't like to disagree or be too disruptive. And I do think sometimes one needs to disrupt. We're in a time, I would suggest, of disruption. So this conversation seemed a little smooth. I mean, you're coming off, as you said, in your good question. I mean, the unrest in Baltimore and other cities that we've seen is about more than a single death or even the single issue of police brutality. It's about structural racism, inequality, and poverty that have pervaded our cities, right, and plagued our society for too long. This conversation was something different. Obama called out conservatives for talking about a commitment to people in poverty, and then conservatives failing to prioritize, slashing budgets that make life harder for people in poverty. He rightly talked about the importance of investing in jobs, communities, schools, neighborhoods, and the danger of what we've been witnessing over, I would argue, the last 30, 40 years, which is disinvestment. He talked about the need for criminal justice reform, but I think maybe the nature of the forum, fair enough, but the ability to go deeper into these issues just wasn't there. For me, one of the important things he did, and I'd love to see a full panel on this with a president or not and a different constellation of characters, is calling out the media. He called out Fox, but he called out other elements of the media for failing to have real conversations about poverty and also for, you know, the propagating of myths and stereotypes and the failure, you know, of what you could see. And I know Greg, again, he was more in the interview format with Bill Moyers, whose show I so miss, but at least talking about how hard it is to be poor, what the struggle looks like in this economy, and what steps could be taken if there was the political will and the vision to truly address, I won't call it, you know, a new war on poverty. I did like coming out of the Georgetown discussion, this idea of ending the of peace, what was it, the peace and the safety net. I thought that was quite good, that there be declaring peace on the safety net, enough with this war on the safety net that too many conservatives have been waging for too long.
I want to unpack a bit of what you just said, and it sounds like you would agree with some of the critiques that Ta-Nehisi Coates of The Atlantic actually brought up, and his name was invoked in a question to the president about the enduring effects of racial discrimination in this country. So I would be curious to understand, when it comes to the policies that are being discussed, how your take is on how we can be more racially conscious and have much more of proactive policies.
You know, it is interesting that Ta-Nehisi Coates' arguments, disagreements with the kind of shallow poverty discussions that go on was raised at this forum. But Ta-Nehisi, of course, speaks for many others. He was raised because he's become an influential media voice. But I do think the issues of structural racism, of hyper-incarceration, of a truly broken criminal justice system, and the inequality that keeps so many African Americans trapped in a prison of poverty need to be discussed. The issue of a serious kind of urban reconstruction agenda that promotes not just education, but full employment that will offer impoverished Americans a path out of the ghetto and hope was kind of danced around. We've lost, I think, a sense of bold political leadership that is needed to make solving extreme poverty a national priority. And in that context, the idea of character and values, you know this better than I, you know, you, Rebecca and Tracy, I mean, the debates that go on are often lacking the complexity and become stereotyped in their own ways. I do think, of course, you know, you pay attention to speaking to people, to families, to character, but too often that passes for a kind of poverty agenda when you really need to look very hard at the decisions being made, the political choices, the priorities, the budgets, the funding. Sure, values and character and my brother's keeper, but that is just not sufficient. And I think the president, you know, he says he spoke as he did, I think it was Morehouse College, because he wanted to be personal. He didn't want to be abstract or have an abstract discussion of poverty. But I do think you fail if you evade the structural issues that have really pushed so many into poverty in these last decades or more.
Not to mention the fact that when he spoke at Morehouse or other places, he's talking to now college graduates.
That's right. And I think the president has a great ability. I think one of the great speeches the president gave was the, I call it the race speech that he gave during the first campaign. But what he, you know, Gary Wills, who's an extraordinary writer and has collected Lincoln speeches, et cetera, really thought that was up there with Gettysburg, the race speech of President Obama's. So I'm just, what I regret is he is someone who knows this country's history, its history both of promise, the steps we've taken toward crafting a more perfect union, but also the failures to address historic segregation and discrimination, and why we need, for example, to truly double down right now on the incarceration, the mass incarceration crisis. And by the way, I've written about how what I call a transpartisan momentum is building around the possibilities of rethinking mass incarceration, the jailing, the failed war on drugs, which has put so many disproportionately African-American Latino men in prison. This needs to be a full priority of the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, and other elements of this government, without ignoring what Robert Putnam, even Arthur Brooks brings up. But you can't just do character and values without addressing the historic structural racism and the segregation in schools, in transportation, in residential life that afflict this country. So, you know, all of that, I think, needed to be a fuller part of the conversation. And I hope President Obama's speech is going forward, because he does seem now more committed to talking about race and the enduring legacy of discrimination.
And that transpartisan momentum around criminal justice reform, I mean, perhaps is best evidenced by the fact that we at the Center for American Progress have joined forces with the Koch brothers to try to actually push forward change within our criminal justice system. But just one final question on the Poverty Summit. You mentioned that Arthur Brooks, the president of the American Enterprise Institute, had reiterated his call to declare peace on the safety net, which I, too, appreciate and hope we will see conservatives both at the federal level and in the states perhaps heed in the future. We haven't seen evidence of that yet.
We have not.
but what we instead heard him say, he, Arthur Brooks, was that our most pressing national problem is that our budget has somehow been overtaken by, quote, middle class entitlements. And he even went so far as to claim that those, quote, middle class entitlements now constitute 70% of our federal budget. Now, it would take us the rest of the episode to explain why that really deserves four Pinocchios from the Washington Post or anyone else that wants to do fact-checking. But I wanted to just pick your brain a little bit about what do you think Brooks is driving at here in making that kind of a claim in this context?
I think Voltaire once said to hold a pen is to be at war. Well, I wish to wage war on Arthur Brooks's statements. I'm not going to declare peace on his version of the safety net. I think this deserves 5, 6, 7 Pinocchios, Washington Post style. We've heard these arguments for decades, decades. This country is one of the, you know, is the richest country in the world. Social Security is the best anti-poverty program this country has seen, most effective one, next to creating jobs. I think we're looking at an effort by conservatives like Arthur Brooks, like AEI, and this is not new, but amped up again, to drive a wedge between anti-poverty advocates and the many advocates committed to Social Security and Medicare, pushing the notion that if we only cut those programs, we could do more to address poverty. I think this is folly. It will undercut both groups. There is also an attempt to drive a wedge between advocates for youth and programs for young people and advocates committed to Social Security and Medicare. So I think the wisdom of those at CAP and other, you know, those who understand what is effective in fighting poverty is going to be needed. The question, you know, that concerns me is whether the president, as he increasingly considers his legacy, may be back to the so-called grand bargain, which we've seen on the table at different times, which is not a bargain. It's a raw deal. It's a raw deal for all, for those struggling to get in the middle class, those living in poverty. And it will mean low-income workers, Americans having to work longer, receiving lower Social Security benefits, people with disabilities who are burdened by so-called reforms to disability programs. So I think it's a raw deal. And progressives, as we've seen, I have to say, you know, a decade ago, the nation advocated for expanding Social Security, not even defending and preserving, but expanding. So I think we're seeing more of those Democrats standing up. Elizabeth Warren is one, Senator Sherrod Brown, a whole cohort in the House around the Progressive Caucus understand how popular and real it is not to talk about cuts, of course, or defending, but expanding retirement security.
You just highlighted a number of important progressive economic policies that we advocate for here. But moving on to a different Brooks, David Brooks recently wrote of a center-right moment in the Britain, Israel, and elsewhere about that progressive economic messages are somehow out of touch with voters. How would you respond to that take?
Well, first of all, I mean, in terms of the UK, I will say that there was a personal moment here. Edward Miliband, head of the Labour Party, was a Nation intern in 1989. And someone who wrote in our pages, in fact, in the 150th special issue, he has a piece he wrote in 1990 about how Labour needs to be bolder and smarter about speaking to the middle class and for economic reforms that will be popular. I think two and a half things. I think what happened in the UK in many ways is not a lesson for the United States. Labour was caught between two nationalisms, Scottish nationalists and the British nationalism. And those nationalisms, more than the left-right ideology, won the day. But furthermore, you know, I disagree with Brooks about interpreting the Miliband loss as a confirmation of public support for so-called fiscal responsibility and a loss for Keynesianism or activist government. It is the case that Miliband and Labour, which is, you know, going through a lot of rethinking, should have been bolder and less engaged with, for example, the deficit issue. Labour danced around reducing the deficit as something critical, as opposed to really full frontally taking on an austerity program, which the Conservative Party has imposed on Britain, and which we've seen across Europe, disastrous impact of massive youth unemployment and loss of growth. So I think lessons are very tough to come by there. What I'd say is we need to think harder in this country about building on something I wrote about in the Washington Post, which is a wonderful alignment of CAP, again, sort of taking the lead with its economic reform agenda earlier this year. But there is a kind of economic populist reform agenda that is uniting progressives, many in the Democratic Party, and aligning the movements of our time with those inside, which I think is so vital. So the fast food workers, Black Lives Matter, immigrant rights, climate crisis movement, and, you know, follow on to Occupy, understanding this is Gilded Age 2.0, and we need all the tools we have to address what I think is the crisis of our time. And Mayor de Blasio unveiled a progressive agenda. Joseph Stiglitz for the Roosevelt Institute talked about rewriting the rules of the economy, which Senator Warren, who participated in that Roosevelt Institute event, said, for years have been rigged to shaft working people. So I think Labour has a lot of thinking to do in the UK, but I think it is wrong to interpret that defeat for Labour as more than it is, and David Brooks, of course, eager to do so.
Well, and another issue that has been much discussed in the last several weeks and has been perhaps another example of the president disappointing many on the left is the issue of a trade deal that Congress has been considering legislation to give the president sort of fast-track authority to strike. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This has not been without controversy. And actually, most recently, we saw a sharp divide emerge in Congress with Democrats in the Senate stopping that legislation, a very public fight happening. Maybe fight's a strong word. You tell me if you disagree. Between Senator Elizabeth Warren and President Obama, now we've seen some more moderate Democrats back off and say that they might actually support a deal. This is obviously still a fluid situation, but help us understand what's at stake here, why Democrats are so opposed, or at least some Democrats, and in particular, why this matters for American workers.
Absolutely. You know, I placed the quite extraordinary debate around the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is roiling the Democratic Party in important ways, in the context of what I was saying earlier, which is this emerging economic populist moment aligned with movements of our time. At heart, I think the Trans-Pacific Partnership battle, and I do think it's been a battle, is about corporate power and who writes the rules of the global economy. Now, That said, the president has accused his opponents of arguing about the past, not the present. But I think, you know, we're looking at the recycling of the same tired arguments that have been used to sell trade deals for more than 20 years. We've seen what happened with NAFTA. We've seen 2 decades of experience with these trade deals, which have racked up unprecedented trade deficits, but more important, have ravaged workers, have helped drive down wages, and contributed directly to America's sinking middle class and inequality. Now, I'm one of those who, you know, not against globalization or trade. The Progressive Caucus in the House, for example, 80 plus strong, Senator Warren, Sherrod Brown, Merkley, Baldwin, the many Democratic senators who opposed the first round of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, are not arguing against globalization or trade. They're arguing that the rules that govern our trade and investment strategies have been rigged by global companies and banks to benefit themselves, not American workers. There's also the issue of transparency. Now, I was on The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, and we had a vigorous dispute because he was telling me, well, you know, this is the way it's always been done on trade agreements. Well, let us change the way it's been done. The fact that we don't know, citizens, senators, don't fully know what's in the TPP agreement because it's still classified, and we had to learn that the private so-called investor-state dispute settlement, which is in the treaty, which gives the right to sue the U.S. if any U.S. or state regulation somehow infringes on future profits, allows foreign investors, that this was known because the chapter was leaked by WikiLeaks. We need to change the way these trade deals are, first of all, organized, proposed, argued, put through. But also, I would argue that we need to change the fundamental thrust of what a trade agreement is so that we can lift up a sinking middle class, that wages can begin to rise. And that is at the heart of the most important opposition. And at the heart of it, again, to be less abstract, is that American workers have seen the effects of these unfair foreign trade agreements on their jobs and manufacturing facilities. They don't need elected leaders making personal attacks on each other during an important policy debate. I regret that it's gotten so, how shall we say, personal and heated. But what it struck me is something Sherrod Brown said, which is he's never seen the president work as hard to get a deal passed. And I think in that, one wishes the president, with all due respect, had put the same effort of lobbying, talking, cajoling by cabinet members, by this administration, put that same effort into, I don't know, Medicare at 55, consumer strengthening on Dodd-Frank.
Our guest is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. Katrina, thank you so much for joining us, and we just need to congratulate you on The Nation's 150th anniversary.
Thank you, and I hope all of you will come to thenation.com. We're launching in sync with the idea of change must come without losing our principles and values as we do so. Come to visit the new website, which we're launching on the birthday of The Nation, July 6th, the actual birthday, July 6th.
Congratulations, and we're excited to see it. Katrina, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. My guest is Patrick McCarthy, President and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Patrick, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. I'm glad to be on with you.
Now, the Annie E. Casey Foundation has a new report out, which was released earlier this week, and it looks at children in America's child welfare system. And in particular, the report's top line finding is that some 57,000 children are placed in group placements instead of with families, and that nearly half of those children have no documented need to be in a group placement setting. So just to get us started, what is a group placement setting, and how does it differ from being with a family?
So there are a number of approaches to group placement. Some of them are residential treatment centers that may range anywhere from 10 children in a residential treatment center up to dozens and dozens of children, even up to over 100. Others are group homes that may be based in the community, but again, they may have anywhere from 6 to 10 or 12 children in them. And then there are what some folks call shelters, where children sometimes are placed, in theory, temporarily in an emergency situation when they're first removed from the home. But unfortunately, many of these shelters end up housing children for weeks and even months as the system fails to find a more appropriate placement for them.
And why did you look at this issue? Why does it matter where a child is placed after they've been removed from their family?
Well, there's a central point of view that we and many others have, and now research has backed it up, and it's fairly straightforward. That is that children do best in families. We have learned that when kids grow up in families, and even families that might be facing some tough times, if those families are supported, then those children have the best chances for success in life, including becoming more successful parents themselves one day. So we started from our core value that we call it the My Family Test. That is, what would we want for our own children? And when we looked at the research as to which kids do well, we discovered that indeed children who grew up in families do much better than children who are placed in group care.
And in particular, your report finds that children placed in group placements are at greater risk of being abused and are more likely to be arrested later on in life, perhaps suggesting that our child welfare system really is part of the puzzle that we need to be looking at as we examine strategies to boost opportunity and mobility for children. What are some of the best practices and really what can we do to improve the child welfare system?
Well, we think there are a range of things that can be done to improve the system. For one, we need to recognize that the first step is to try to support the child's own family so that it's possible for the child to remain there safely. And that sometimes requires some intensive intervention and some support for the parents. But if that's not possible, and sometimes it's not, sometimes a child is better off being removed from a family, of course, the next step is to think about, are there relatives who could step in and help care for the child through this emergency situation? Often a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, a cousin, someone that the child knows and that knows the family is the next best resource for many children. If that's not possible, if there aren't any kin available who are willing to step up and take the child in, we believe that in most situations, a foster family is the next best solution. What we found is that the systems that really support the foster families and the kin families by providing them not only with counseling and support, but helping them think through how do they manage a child's behavioral problems, for example. These families do very, very well, even with children who might have some challenging behaviors. In fact, when you interview foster families who have decided to stop fostering and who leave the system, and you ask why they've made that decision, almost half say because they did not feel supported by the child welfare system. They did not feel like they were given the tools, and that when they did have a problem, they weren't able to get help with that. So we need to invest in birth families and in kinship families and also in foster families so that they are able to take in the children who don't require residential treatment. Second, we think it's very important that the decision to place a child in a group setting be seen for what it is, a very important and potentially life-changing decision. And that means it ought not be made on the spur of the moment. We ought to have a team looking at the needs of the child, making sure that if residential treatment is necessary, and sometimes it is, that if residential treatment is necessary, the child is placed in a residential treatment center that really fits what the child's needs are. We also believe that part of that review process ought to include oversight so that if a child is placed in residential treatment, it should only be for the length of time necessary to deal with the child's behavioral or mental health issue. So that means the agency itself and in some cases the courts ought to review that placement to make sure it's still necessary. And finally, we know that child welfare systems are certainly working hard to do the best they can for children. It's important that they have the full range of services available. We find that when child welfare systems have let their foster care system decay and when they don't have enough foster parents, that's the situation in which we see more children going into group care, simply because the system doesn't have enough foster families, not because of the child's needs. And one last point, as you will see in the report, the percentage of children in child welfare that are in group care versus foster care varies greatly, from as little as 5% of all kids in care in places like Kansas and Maine, it's 4% in Oregon, to places where more than a third, like in Colorado, 35% of the children who are in care are in residential treatment. We see in West Virginia, it's 27%. In Wyoming, it's 27%. The point being that if places like Kansas and Maine and Oregon and several others have figured out how to keep children in families, certainly other states ought to be able to do the same.
Something I saw quite frequently as a legal aid lawyer working with low-income families was that children would often be removed from their family homes essentially due to poverty. The gas or the water had been shut off for non-payment, for example, or the youngest kids would be left in the care of the older kids while mom was at work because she couldn't secure affordable child care. And these living conditions might be considered unsuitable for the child. How does that fit in with the bigger picture here?
Well, I think it's important for folks to understand that although the cases that get a lot of attention in the press are some of the horrible tragedies involving severe physical abuse or very severe neglect, the average situation is actually much different. Nationally, about 78% of the families that come to the attention of child welfare come to the attention of child welfare because of neglect that is related to poverty, exactly the kinds of situations you're talking about. So it's a very high proportion of the families that come to the attention of child welfare who are there because of poverty and neglect. The other factor that folks often don't realize is that when a teenager comes into the child welfare system, it's more often than not because of abuse or neglect of the teenager, but rather the teenager's own behavioral or mental health issue that the parent or guardian feels they can no longer manage. And so although it may be considered technically neglect because the parent is saying themselves, I can't parent this child at this point, in fact, that's a great example of where some investment in the family, some help for the parent, or in some cases it might be a grandparent who's taking care of the child, could potentially keep that child with the child's own family or with the kin family. It's striking that one out of three teenagers who are in child welfare placement are in group care. And we think that is primarily because of the inability of families to manage the child's kind of adolescent acting out. And that with the right supports and the right treatment, in fact, the child could be maintained in his or her own home.
And since you brought up teenagers, a related issue that the Annie E. Casey Foundation has looked at is foster youth and specifically the transition to independence. And too often, many foster youth really aren't prepared for that transition. Many end up dropping out of high school, can end up homeless, or they're more likely to be economically disadvantaged as adults and even to be justice involved. How do we reverse these trends and set them up for success?
Well, there's a range of things. We begin with the fundamental notion, as I said before, that children do best when they are in families. And that is especially true for teenagers, especially when teenagers have perhaps been traumatized or had very difficult life experiences. What we find is that when teenagers spend too long in group placement, they report, the teenagers themselves, the young people report feeling dehumanized. They don't have any privacy. They have shift workers who come and go. Their days are very regimented. They don't have opportunities to do the normal things that teenagers would be allowed to do, such as date and hang out with their friends and just be adolescents. So we have looked at the patterns for those young people who age out of foster care. They reach the maximum age that the state is involved with them. And we've compared situations in which the teenager has spent most of their time in foster care versus most of their time in group care. What we find is the teenagers who have spent most of the time in group care do indeed often go on to have the kinds of problems that you're talking about, including homelessness, unemployment, not completing education, getting involved in the justice system, and long-term economic impact. So we've tried to work with states to say, obviously, some young people do need a period of residential treatment, but that should not be a destination. That should not be a final placement. Even in those situations, the core of the approach ought to be, how do we keep the family engaged? How do we find a family for children who can't go back to their own family? And recognize that the best chance of success that a child has, exactly as the title of our document says, every child needs a family, every kid needs a family. How do we make that a reality is really what we're trying to achieve.
Patrick McCarthy, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio. Where can our listeners find this report?
They can go to our website, which is aecf.org, and find it there. And there's also lots of additional data on our Kids Count website as well, which they can reach through the aecf.org website.
And the report is called Every Kid Needs a Family, Giving Children in the Child Welfare System the Best Chance for Success. Patrick McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us today, and I really appreciate you shining a light on this important issue.
Thank you very much, Rebecca.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. A recent multi-part series in the New York Times by Sarah Maslin Neer highlighted the exploitation of nail salon workers and the horrific health consequences that many of them face. That series has spurred a national conversation about nail salons. It focused on New York City, but a lot of the issues the series raises are familiar to those of us in cities across the country. With me to discuss the series, as well as the broader issue of exploitation in the nail salon industry, is Maya Pinto, Economic Justice Program Director at the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. Thank you so much for joining us, Maya.
Rebecca, thanks so much for having me.
Now, based on the New York Times investigative reporting, it's probably not news to a lot of our listeners that nail salon workers are by and large immigrants. Many speak very little English. Many are undocumented. And they're also almost entirely women. Is this a combination that makes them particularly vulnerable to exploitation?
Absolutely. Yes. So these factors, right? Limited English proficiency, being undocumented. First of all, they limit job options for women who really need to work to make ends meet. When Napoff spoke to workers, so many said that this was literally the only job that they could find. They felt, in a sense, trapped in that job. And so they endured low wages, ill treatment, job-related illnesses, because earning that paycheck was their means of survival. And their lack of other job options also prevented them from organizing. So they feared retaliation, that they would be fired and then blacklisted by the whole industry. So a number of workers said they wanted to organize for better conditions, but the risk of not having any work was just too great. For workers who lack English proficiency, a lot of them said that they didn't really know their rights because information wasn't accessible in their language. Workers who are undocumented might fear reporting workplace violations that would result in immigration enforcement being brought in, or their employers might threaten that they'll call immigration enforcement if they report workplace violations.
Well, and to dig a little bit deeper into maybe why this goes on and why nail salon workers are so vulnerable, in a report that that Napoff put out a few years ago, back in 2011, since you guys have been working on this for a long time, long before the New York Times brought this to many of our attention, you say the plight of nail salon workers sits at the intersection of the environmental justice, economic justice, immigrant rights, and reproductive justice movements. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. I would say that nail salon worker advocacy sits at the intersection of these various movements because workers' needs for full labor protections and access to licensing as immigrant workers, as undocumented workers, those are immigrant rights issues. Workers' needs for better wages and benefits, those are economic justice issues. workers' needs for, you know, stronger regulations of the harmful chemicals in nail salon products. Those can be seen as an environmental justice issue, and workers' need for clean products that aren't reproductive toxicants, that don't cause birth defects and miscarriages, that's a reproductive justice issue. So all of these issues, it's really an intersectional campaign and an intersectional advocacy that's required.
And that series documents horrifying health effects stemming from the toxic chemicals that nail salon workers are exposed to. One woman's fingerprints literally disappeared. Several have their hands break out in painful black pustules. Several end up with cancer and respiratory problems. I could go on and on. Is working with chemicals like this that can cause these types of health effects even legal? And if so, how is that?
Yes, Rebecca. You know, it's horrifying, but working with harmful, even deadly chemicals is absolutely legal under the current framework. The problem is that the multi-billion dollar cosmetics industry is not adequately regulated right now. There are gaping holes in the framework that allow chemicals that are highly toxic. They allow known carcinogens. The FDA can't test cosmetics before they're introduced onto the market. They can't even recall products that are found to be dangerous. And we are currently relying on the cosmetics industry to self-monitor its products prior to market introduction. So some people have referred to this as a fox guarding the hen house situation, and I absolutely agree. And the result of that is that you have highly dangerous chemicals that are causing injury to consumers and that are injuring and even killing nail salon workers onto the market.
Are these types of exploitative and indeed flagrantly illegal practices specific to New York City, or is this going on elsewhere in the United States?
Well, what I do know is that these issues, unfortunately, are not specific to New York City. So NAPOF, we've done some survey research of our own. We've done surveys of nail salon workers in three U.S. cities. New York City is one of them, but we've also surveyed workers in Washington, D.C., and in San Francisco, and we found wage and hour violations across the board. So we found that workers are not receiving overtime, you know, despite working up to 80 hours per week. They aren't receiving any breaks at all. They're earning as little as $15 per day. And another thing we found is evidence that many workers are actually nail salon employees, but they're being misclassified as independent contractors, as self-employed workers. Now, independent contractors aren't protected by minimum wage and overtime laws by OSHA standards, and so this is a really big problem. And so, you know, that's what we know based on our own surveys, but it's really likely that exploitation is happening everywhere just because of the lack of oversight and enforcement of laws that are on the books across the U.S. and the absence of a strong floor of standards for nail salon workers across the country.
Now, I'm going to come out and admit that from time to time, I get manicures and sometimes even pedicures. And I know that many of my female friends do. And I have to say, in talking about this New York Times series with them and in mentioning that I was going to be talking with you for Talk Poverty Radio, several of them asked the question, how does one get an ethical manicure? And is that even possible?
Yeah, this is a great question. And, you know, it really is a question that sort of drives this work, right? Because we want business to be ethical. We want to be able to receive the services like manicures and pedicures. We want to make sure that workers are paid properly and that workplaces are safe. There's a lot of work we get to do to be able to guarantee that manicures are ethical, you know, to ensure that workers are being paid fairly, treated with respect, that products are safe. I think it's a good idea for people to talk the owners of the nail salon where they go and tell the owners that, you know, you're willing to pay more if the workers are paid a living wage and if the salon invests in good ventilation systems. And I think people should organize their friends to do the same. And, you know, if you're in some areas of California or in Seattle, you can visit a certified healthy nail salon where, you know, this is in the Santa Monica area in San Francisco. And in San Mateo, they have healthy nail salon programs, and so does Seattle. And these programs require salons to use toxic-free nail products, to have personal protective gear for the workers, and in many cases have good ventilation systems.
And now back to New York. A few days after the New York Times series broke, Governor Cuomo announced a whole spate of emergency measures in response to the reporting. It included new health standards to protect nail salon workers from toxic chemicals, the formation of a task force that would be conducting salon by salon investigations. Now, your organization, NAPOF, was critical of his announcement. And in particular, you expressed concern about the salon-by-salon investigations. Can you say a little more about whether you think the governor's steps were what is needed and whether and what your specific concerns are about the idea of salon-by-salon crackdowns?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we did. We had some concerns after the initial announcement about the impact on workers, but we've had the opportunity actually to talk those concerns through. And now that the full details on the program are out, NAPOF supports the actions that are being taken in New York. So Governor Cuomo is actually establishing the strongest safety and wage theft protections for nail salon workers, for all nail salon workers, including undocumented nail salon workers in the country, and is expanding access to the licensing and labor rights information, and is actually committed to really work with community groups to make sure that there's outreach to nail salon owners and to workers, and to protect to workers and workers' jobs and to try and improve conditions. And, you know, we'd like to build on the governor's actions.
Now, I want to just add before we wrap up, it's not just cheap manicures, right? I mean, it's in many parts of our lives, we've really become accustomed to artificially low-cost luxury goods. Another prime example being trendy clothes manufactured in sweatshops so that they can be sold here in the United States at really bargain basement prices. Do you see a pattern here?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, too often, I think low prices of both goods and services are predicated on the exploitation of workers. It's true. And I think we need to be more conscious consumers and really think about, you know, the true cost of a low price. A lot of times, I think because of long supply chains that spread across the globe, we're so far removed from the workers that make the products we use. I think when it comes to services, though, and especially when it comes to nail salon services, when it comes to those nail salon workers, the interaction is actually quite intimate. So, you know, we're holding hands with a woman who may be being exploited. And because we have that direct contact, I think we have even more power perhaps to change things. You know, we're there. We can talk directly to owners and, again, tell them we'd be willing to pay more for a manicure if the nail salon pays a living wage and invests in effective ventilation systems. And we can support local worker organizing. We can support local policy efforts that will increase protections for workers and beef up regulations. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The exploitation of nail salon workers is absolutely part of a much larger trend. And, you know, there need to be more New York Times exposés and swift responses from government officials, interest by the media, consumer outrage, and like a consumer drive to really end this exploitation and unsafe conditions in the workplaces.
Maya Pinto, where can we learn more about NAPOF's work and also the work of the National Healthy Nail Salon Alliance?
Yes, so people, if they'd like to learn more about NAPOF's work, they can visit our website, which is www.napof.org. They can find us on Twitter at NAPOF and on Facebook at facebook.com/NAPOF.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on Talk Poverty Radio to discuss this important topic with us.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast, or you can listen online at weactradio.com. Special thanks to our executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and the one and only Greg Kaufman.
Special thanks also go out to our great intern, Will Strong.
CAP's amazing poverty and press teams.
And as always, DC's own Chris Stiles Bacon gets the last word. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. Mint. And it got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food and health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom.
You are listening to the We Act Radio Network, produced in Washington, D.C. Visit us online at weactradio.com.